Morning. We welcome you all to the courtroom, but we have a special welcome for the Union Grove High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming today. You may be seated. The Union Grove High School students are here with a national award-winning program cleverly entitled Court with Class. This program is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from across the state to come join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they come. They've been given material relating to this case, and after this case, they will be joined by other students, and we'll have a discussion with a justice assigned today to discuss matters with the students. The discussion will be on the procedures and process of handling the cases, that is, taking them and deciding them. The discussion will not be on the substantive issues of the case. Everyone in the courtroom, whether student or not, is invited to join the discussion right after this case. If anyone would like material relating to the case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary of the case. It's easier to listen to the case if you do have a summary of the facts and the legal issues. Right. And we have someone. While the marshal is handing out the materials, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice assigned today to meet with the students. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left, your right, is Justice Patrick Crooks, and seated next to him is Justice Pat Robinsack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our next case, which is 10-AP-258, Teresa C. Weber. Is it Weberg or Weborg?
Weborg.
Weborg versus Donald B. Jenny. Arguing on behalf of Miss Weborg is J. Michael End. And counsel, you may take the podium.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Michael End. I'm here with my partner, Jerry Hirschman, representing the Weborg family. When all of us were in law school, we learned the rules that have been enacted and made better over the years in order to ensure that in our courts, justice is accomplished. One of the foundations of the rules that we have learned for achieving justice in our courts is the rule of relevancy. Relevancy means that at a trial, the fact finder, the jurors, are only exposed to information that will help the jurors justly decide the case. One of the cases cited by the defense in their brief was the Carney Hayes case, which you may recall has to do with what information, what opinions have to be given by doctors, either non-parties or parties. And in that decision, written by Justice Prosser, this court said, the court may also employ evidentiary rules, including WIS Stat Section 90402, parent relevant evidence, irrelevant evidence, 90403, parent, exclusion of relevant evidence on grounds of prejudice, confusion, and 906.11, parent, mode and order of interrogation and presentation controlled by judge to maintain the focus of a medical malpractice trial on whether the defendant conformed to the applicable standard of care. A corollary that has developed in Wisconsin law, and in fact was just last week again incorporated by this court, is the collateral source rule. Justice Crooks last week in that decision gave the three reasons for the why the collateral source rule is here in Wisconsin. The reasons are to deter a tortfeasor's negligent conduct by placing the full cost of the wrongful conduct on the tortfeasor. Number two, to fully compensate the injured party. And number three, and something that I think is very important in this case that we're talking about today, is to allow the insured to receive the benefit of the premiums paid for coverage that he or she had the foresight to purchase.
Counsel, does it affect your argument at all that this was not a damages trial? And second, when the evidence came in, why didn't you ask for a curative instruction?
Well, when the evidence came in, it came in as a result of the pretrial order. I no longer had a right to raise a stink as far as I was concerned.
Did you ask the judge, though, if this is going to come in, judge, then I'd like an instruction on it? Or
We never got that far. In fact, the whole discussion, pretrial, is in the record. And I objected for the very same reasons that I'm here today objecting to that information being given to the jury. And, you know, we all know that Section 89355.7 was enacted in 1995, and it was interpreted by this court in 2005 in the Lagerstrom decision. And this court determined that, and there was a challenge, by the way, to the constitutionality of the statute. And this court said, well, in order not to mess with the constitutional issues, we're going to construe this statute very narrowly. And this court said, information about collateral sources may be introduced in evidence for the purpose of helping the jurors. So we get a relevance issue in here, helping the jurors to determine the fair value of the medical care.
So that's back to my original question. If this isn't a damages trial, how does it impact your case?
Well, this certainly was a damage trial. And as the briefs have said, there were a lot of pages of testimony related to the damage aspects of the case. And we had a professor from Marquette, Professor Breeden, who did the formula. You know, he said, here's what the income that this man would have made. And as you know, Mr. Weborg died at age 42. He owned his own company. So the evidence is, here's what he would have made. Here's what he would have consumed. And here are the value of his household services, bringing it all back to present value. So we submitted all of that into evidence. At the close of our case, the lawyer for the fund, Mr. Wolski, came up to me and said, I've talked to the other defense lawyers, and we're willing to stipulate to damages. And I talked with Mrs. Weborg, and we said, okay, we'll stipulate to $1 million. And in fact, Professor Breeden's numbers came to just over $1 million for pecuniary loss, plus there was the $350,000 potential recovery for loss of society and companionship. We talked it over and decided we're going to stipulate to the $1 million, and that's what we did. And so this was a damage case all the way through until the conclusion of our case.
Right, but the jury didn't have to make a determination on damages, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so I mean, that's what I meant by that. So I'm trying to figure out where, how the admission of that evidence impacted your case as to liability.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I answer that with three answers. Number one, the amount of life insurance in this particular case was over the top to the average person. $1,425,000. And as I said in my brief, the only thing that Mrs. Wiborg was entitled to recover if successful in this case is money damages. That's all our law provides. So she's in court seeking compensation. The jury hears $1,425,000 plus Social Security monthly payments of $3,300, which adds up to $39,600 a year. And the jurors, and the second basis for my argument is the judge will confirm this, but the jurors listening to that had to have thought, well, what the heck is Mrs. Wiborg in court doing? She's here asking for money when she just got $1,425,000. She's getting $39,600 in Social Security. And the second of my points is the trial court, Judge Ehlers, who was there watching the jurors intently for this 8-day trial, on motions after verdict, and let me tell you exactly what he said because it was very strong. He said, there is no question that information come out in front of the jury as to collateral sources of income the plaintiff or her family may have received is prejudice. And then later on he said, I will not say if I screwed it up, it didn't make any difference now because damages were resolved as the trial progressed. So the trial court said that, and that's one of the reasons that I raised in my petition for review is the Court of Appeals never mentioned the trial court's decision, his statement, I think this was prejudicial, and I have given you cases from Wisconsin that say in a situation like that, that's the type of situation where the trial court, right there watching his fellow citizens from Door County, is better able to determine whether this was prejudicial than people reading the record. And I've given you the quotes from the Wisconsin cases.
Well, in this case, there still is no argument on the amount of damages, right? Should you win on liability, we've agreed, or there's been an agreement on $1 million. So your position here, if I understand it, is that you put in evidence to the jury that the doctors involved here did not correctly treat the defendant. That is, that they did not exercise appropriate, reasonable care of similar doctors in the area. And that these doctors were therefore negligent, medical malpractice, therefore you should recover. And the jury was asked if these doctors performed within the reasonable standard of care, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the jury said, hey, these doctors were not negligent, right?
That's right.
They did not perform below the standard of care that the law requires, right?
Correct.
And you're here to say, if I understand this case, that the fact that the jury heard that the widow was going to recover under life insurance plus Social Security, $1,000,003, prejudiced them to say these doctors were not negligent. And hadn't they heard, if the jury had not heard that she was going to collect $1.3 million, they might have, on the basis of the evidence submitted, and it was conflicted evidence, right?
Yes.
They might have said the doctors were negligent, right? But that they didn't feel sorry for her, felt more sorry for the doctors, because she already had $1 million.
That's correct, Your
Honor.
That's
your position here.
And actually, and the third point I was going to make is this Supreme Court, in Leninger versus DeBart, 2007, made this statement: the collateral source rule excludes evidence of other compensation on the theory that such evidence would affect the jury's judgment unfavorably to the plaintiff on the issues of liability and damages. So this court in 2007 said putting in collateral source information is so prejudicial that it affects liability as well as damages. And in fact, in that same case, this court said, one justification advanced for the collateral source rule is that the introduction of evidence that the plaintiff received benefits is inherently prejudicial to the plaintiff. And I didn't stop with Wisconsin cases. I provided you with six or seven cases, federal cases, cases from other states that hold exactly the same thing. And what these cases are telling us is that if you put this evidence in, the jurors are going to view this case differently.
The reason it's prejudicial is not that it's against your client, because all evidence that doesn't favor you is prejudicial in that sense. Prejudicial in the law means that the jury is using that evidence for an element or a factor for which they cannot use it.
Correct.
Or that it's evidence that so taints the proceeding that it can be unfair, like a gruesome picture.
Exactly.
That's what prejudice means, and that's your position.
Exactly. And when this statute was enacted, you know, I understand the legislature thought back in 1995 there was a medical malpractice problem, and so they enacted this statute. But the reality is that for this particular case, for, you know, the legislature didn't say everything goes in. All collateral source information goes in. It says is admissible. It doesn't say
admissible
shall be
admitted. Damages.
It's admissible at the discretion of the trial court, and it's, and our point in this case is it still has to be relevant. And in this case, there was absolutely no possible relevance for putting this inflammatory information into the case.
Well, but what bothers me about the case is, as you stated, until the very end, damages were an issue, right?
Yes.
So at what point did the defendant put in the evidence of the insurance?
That was put in during our case when Mrs. Wiborg testified, and it was based upon the ruling of Judge Ehlers.
Okay. Is it your position that even if damages were an issue here and were not stipulated, should this evidence be admitted?
Absolutely not.
Okay. So it's irrelevant whether damages were an issue in this case as far as you're concerned.
This evidence under no circumstances could have any relevance in this case, because these were collateral source funds coming in because Mr. Wiborg went out and spent thousands of dollars to buy life insurance. It could not play any role in the determination of pecuniary loss. There's no relationship whatsoever between how much life insurance a person has and what the pecuniary damages under the law are. So under no circumstances should this have come in. And what happened is, as you know from looking at the record, Judge Ehlers, at the insistence of the defendants, the defense lawyers were saying, Judge, you don't have discretion. The law mandates you give this information, whether it's relevant or not. And he read your case and said, I agree. I think Lagerstrom requires that this come into evidence, whether it's relevant or not. And that's what happened.
Mr. And, the Court of Appeals came to the conclusion that, assuming that you're right, assuming that that evidence should not have come in, that still it was harmless error. I've got a couple of questions in that regard. First of all, what test do we apply in regard to harmless error? Do we look at the statute, which would be at 805.18, which talks about substantial rights, or do we look at the Nader Harvey approach, or what test do we apply to harmless error?
I think we use that approach. The is there a possibility that this verdict would have been different if this evidence had not come in? But what I'm suggesting is that this court make a clear rule that in the future, in cases like this, we are going to give deference to the trial judge who was there watching those jurors. And he didn't make any doubt about it. On motions after, he said this to the defense lawyers who were arguing that. This is harmless error, judge. And he said to them, damages be darned. I don't care. It's my view that if I was wrong in allowing this in, it did prejudice the plaintiff. And so what I'm suggesting is we adopt that. We put it in black and white that in the future, when the trial court, and we already have case law, but the Court of Appeals never mentioned Judge Ehlers. And I think somehow this court has to get the message out in situations like that. And I gave you cases where you've already said that. The trial court's finding that this was prejudicial is something that the appellate courts have to give deference to because it's a different deal. You know, he was there watching these 12 people. He was there when the evidence came in. He saw how they reacted to it. He was there for the entire trial, and his determination was this was not harmless.
Counsel, if I understand your argument, there would be no place in a medical malpractice action where you could apply 893.55.7, right? Isn't that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying other than the Lagerstrom decision that says clearly the collateral payments are admissible in evidence with the added jury instruction that you are not to reduce your determination of the fair value of medical care by those insurance proceeds that were paid.
So you think you can have the insurance proceeds come in, but nothing else can come in under subsection 7? Am I reading? Is that right?
Well, if there's something, if it somehow becomes relevant, I think you can. You know, if, for example, if somebody said, yeah, I'm destitute. I don't have any money. My three boys and I are starving. Then I think, hey, didn't you get $1,425,000? I think you can get it in if it's relevant. But under the circumstances of this case, I don't think there's any way in the world that bringing that very inflammatory evidence into the case was relevant to any issue that the jury had to determine.
Mr. Ann, going back for a minute to harmless error, do you think it's appropriate for the court to not only look at the fact that at the end damages was not at issue, but also to look at the jury verdict itself? And the jury verdict basically found that the doctors were not negligent, found that your deceased here was negligent. Now, admittedly, the finding was no cause. But that finding seems to be something else that would be appropriate to look at in regard to harmless error. No damages in the case at the end. Now, they were there in the middle. I understand that. And the fact that the jury put all of the blame, though not causal, on Mr. Weborg. How does that work with harmless error?
Well, it seemed to me that the jurors were resentful of Mrs. Weborg's recovering that compensation. And I don't know if this court is as aware of this as those of us who do this law all the time, but it has gotten to the point in Wisconsin where it is virtually impossible for a plaintiff in a medical malpractice trial to win. And I was in a trial 4 weeks ago. I'm doing voir dire, and we're asking questions. The jurors are raising their hand. There are too many lawsuits. I hate these big million-dollar verdicts, and I can't do this, but I was tempted to ask the jurors, so which of those five plaintiffs' verdicts last year do you have a problem with? Or the two plaintiffs' verdicts the year before? And what I'm telling you is these are really tough cases, and when you get evidence like we got in this case, the plaintiff got $1,425,000, it's what tips the balance. We had a strong case. The defense did a fine job, three excellent defense lawyers. But when you get evidence like this in, it's what tips the balance. And that's, I think, what Judge Ehlers was saying. And he said, you know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, and I'm not going to say this didn't make a difference because I think it did.
Are you arguing at all, counsel, that the statute is simply unconstitutional?
Well, I think that argument was made in 2005, and I think that the majority opinion said in order to avoid doing that, we're going to find a way that this evidence will be relevant to an issue, namely the reasonable value of the medical care. So I think as interpreted, I can go along with that. I think it's relevant in that situation. But in a situation like this, I would say, and in fact, the defense argued at trial, they're arguing today, you can let it all in. We don't have to worry about relevance. I'm saying if that's what the fact of the matter is, then it's darn unconstitutional. You know, we have to come to our decisions based on a rational basis, based upon the facts that should be admitted, not based upon prejudicial information. And I was thinking about this last night. Let's say the legislature in 1995 had said, you know, that rule of law that if somebody's been convicted of a crime, then it's worked out ahead of time, and if it's three times, then as long as the person says, I've been convicted three times, that's it. But we'll say, but for medical malpractice, we'll tell what the crime is. We'll change the law in medical malpractice. That's not the way it ought to be. And we have to be making sure that our laws in Wisconsin do the best they can to achieve justice. And what happened in this case, in my view, was horrible and prevented us from achieving justice.
If I can recall the Lagerstrom case, where I was in dissent, as you recall.
Yes.
The majority said evidence can come in, but there would be an instruction to the jury as to what they could do with that evidence. Put it bluntly, did you make a mistake by agreeing to stipulation of $1 million damages? Because then there was no instruction to the jury.
And, you know, if I made a mistake, it was a potential $1 million mistake, but that never came around. I mean, the fact of the matter was the decision was made, the evidence was in, and as I said in my brief, once the jurors heard that, that's the event. I mean, once the jurors, they walked into the jury room And, you know, I don't know what they said, but I've got to be thinking that they were saying, holy cow, this lady got $1,425,000.
Is it your position that regardless of, even if this had been damages included, and they had awarded, that they decided there was no liability, you'd be here? That is...
I would.
That your position is that insurance money can't be introduced regardless.
Not life insurance, because it's not relevant.
You're absolutely right. In the Lagerstrom and others, it was health insurance and medical pay.
Correct.
This is life insurance. It doesn't have anything to do with the value of the
pecuniary loss.
Yeah, or medical expenses.
Correct.
Well, apparently your theory would include... If you hadn't stipulated the $1 million, apparently you said earlier in your oral argument that your expert would have said something over about $1.1 million.
Yeah, he did say that.
So once the judge let the information in about the $1.4 million, if you hadn't stipulated, then you would have had your own expert saying that the damages were something less than...
The insurance proceeds.
...already paid up.
Because it is completely two different concepts.
I understand that, but I think that goes to a question you were asked a few minutes ago.
Okay.
Okay.
And then the other issue, of course, is the jury instruction. And the thing that really, you know, if you read the transcript, I was scratching my head trying to figure out, and the judge even said, well, come on, Mr. Wren, you understand this, but that jury instruction made no sense. That was given on expert testimony. The judge at the asking of the defense lawyer said, okay, I'm going to give it. The Court of Appeals said that jury instruction was so nonsensical that we don't think it made a difference. And my question is, why are we giving a jury instruction to the jurors in this trial in Door County if when the instruction is given is so nonsensical and we say it's a harmless error, it doesn't make any difference. I think if, and again, please look at that instruction and talk about it among yourselves because, again, the defense here is claiming the jury instruction was okay. I've read it 1,000 times, including when it was first offered up at the trial. It makes absolutely no sense. And for
the defense to be comprehensive is saying that in conjunction with the following about reconciling expert opinions.
Well, what it said, the normal 260 says you are not bound by any expert's opinion.
I know what it said, but then they're arguing, the defense is arguing something in addition, cure that. I don't want to, the red light is on, I don't want to belabor this
I'm
point.
I'm sorry.
But that's.
Thank you.
Wait, just counsel, does anyone else have any questions of the witness? All right, thank you. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Michael V. Van Sicklin, representing Donald H. Jenny and the other healthcare providers covered here. Mr. Van Sicklin.
Good morning, Your Honors, in this beautiful spring day. May it please the court. As you know, I'm Michael B. Van Sicklin. With me is my colleague who helped on the briefs, Krista Sturken. We're both of the Madison office of Foley and Lardner. It's our privilege to represent the four healthcare providers who prevailed in both courts below, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals. Before turning to the two issues, I want to start with a basic word about the context. Whereas here an appellant seeks the extraordinary remedy of overturning a jury verdict and ordering a new trial, it's appropriate to consider the underlying context of the trial and the incredible burden that would be imposed on the respondents in the trial court to have a new trial in this situation. This was an 8-day jury trial. The evidence we submit was so overwhelming in favor of the doctors that at the close of the plaintiff's case, they abandoned their claim for damages in excess of $1 million and entered into the damage stipulation and dismissed the patient compensation fund, the provider of the umbrella protection. At the close of the case, the jury returned a verdict that found that none of the three doctors was even 1% negligent, none were causally responsible for the injury to Mr. Wiborg, and that only the patient, Mr. Wiborg, was negligent. Now,
what were the instructions given about using the insurance money?
There were no instructions given, Your Honor, because at the close of the plaintiff's case, the parties stipulated to the $1 million damages. At that point in time, I think there was some confusion in the earlier questioning. Mr. End is the one that introduced the questions about the collateral source evidence. He also put in extensive evidence about damages during his case through Mrs. Wiborg, the children, his damage expert, and the like. And then they arrived at the stipulation pursuant to which the plaintiff got benefits as well as the defense. And at that point, the trial court turned to all the counsel in the courtroom and said, would you like me to tell the jury anything about damages? Should I give an instruction? All the lawyers, including Mr. N, said no. We're not going to tell the jury anything about the damage stipulation. At that point forward, we then had 4 or 5 additional days of jury trial during which the defense put its case on. Not a single word was said about damages by the defense. Neither side mentioned it in closing arguments. There was no request by plaintiff for any kind of instruction about the damage evidence. And respectfully, if the jury was wondering anything when they went into that room, it was, why didn't the defense put any evidence in rebuttal about damages? If anything, the defense was the side prejudiced by the stipulation in terms of not telling anything to the jury about how to evaluate all the damage evidence.
Did the defense put in the evidence about the insurance policy, the life insurance policy?
No, they did not. It came in the plaintiff's case. There was
in cross-examination.
There was a question about the dollar amount. Yes, Your Honor.
The fund.
Actually, it was the fund, ironically, who then got dismissed afterwards. It wasn't by the remaining doctor's counsel that asked.
But it doesn't seem that the defense would have had to have put in any evidence about the damages, because they had the ruling from the trial court judge about the $1.4 million, and then later on they had the stipulation. When I read the transcript and the briefs, it seems to me that the proponent of the idea would probably try to elicit the information for the same reason a prosecutor would elicit the information about prior convictions, because you don't want the other side to do it as an aha moment. So if there's something unfavorable, get it out from your own witness. So I'm not clear on your reliance. I noted it in the briefs, too, about the fact that they introduced it. Of course they're going to introduce it, it seemed to me, unless I'm wrong, because they know they have the pretrial ruling that it's going to come in.
But they made no effort in crafting the stipulation, Your Honor, to preserve the error. It was rendered moot. The issue of damages, 893.55(7) is a damage statute. And there was no instructions about damages. The jury wasn't told anything about damages. And the plaintiffs participated in that result. And so, again, and I'd like to turn to Justice Crooks. You asked, you know, what the standard would be here on the harmless error side. I think the two sides agree.
Is there an error?
Pardon me?
Was there error here?
No, there's no error at all. And I'm going to turn to the reasons why there was no error. But if there was, arguendo, it's the Wiborg's burden to show that it was so prejudicial as to undermine the confidence in the bottom line outcome. Respectfully, nothing in this record shows that the Wiborgs had demonstrated that the outcome was wrong, and we submit it was consistent with the overwhelming weight of the evidence here. Now, turning to the collateral source issue, we believe that the defense wins on 3 independent grounds. First, the ruling in limine by the trial court was correct. The Wiborgs, both in their briefs and in the oral argument today, respectfully, completely confused the standards applicable under common law to all tort cases other than Med-Mal cases, and the fact that we have a statute directly on point that governs the admission of collateral source evidence in Chapter 5-5 medical malpractice cases like this.
Counsel, I know you're going to get to second and third, but since you're right on the statute, the first words of the statute, sub 7, indicate evidence of any compensation for bodily injury received. What was the evidence of compensation for bodily injury received? I'm not talking about for death, but for bodily injury received that was submitted.
Well, I think, Your Honor, death is a bodily injury.
And that's really getting to my, I always, this involves the fund, too. But in cases that involve insurance policies, I always say, where's the insurance policy? That's the contract. And does this life insurance policy, if there is a policy in the record, does it say the life insurance policy is the proceeds are being paid upon death, or do they say it's being paid upon bodily injury? And the fund, what can I look to that will help me answer the question of whether amounts paid by the fund, if there are there's some kind of a determination between compensation for death as opposed to bodily injury.
When you say the fund, you're talking about the patient compensation fund?
Yeah. I mean,
They were dismissed out of this case.
Well, they're dismissed because they don't cover everything over $1 million, right?
Right.
And the agreement here is that this is within the million. So that's why they're dismissed. It's not a substantive.
But initially they were part of this case. I mean, when the evidentiary ruling was made at the pretrial, weren't they part of this case?
They were part of the case until the end of the plaintiff's case.
So my question is and remains, what can you show me in this record that compensation is made for bodily injury? I haven't, to be honest, look at life insurance policies. You know, we get CGLs, we get the UMs, we get the auto stuff. And a lot of the things that we have recently of property, you know, bodily injury and property damage. So I am not familiar with the normal terminology that appears in a life insurance policy. And so I want to know if those kinds of policies, if the norm is that the compensation is paid for death, or is the terminology used that the compensation is being paid for bodily injury?
Well, I haven't done some kind of a survey with that question in mind, Your Honor, but my experience, it's life insurance is paid at death, but that death is a type of bodily, it's the bodily injury they claim from the what they claim was negligent medical care led to his bodily injury, a heart attack, stroke, mm-hmm. and his death.
I don't think in other kinds
he didn't
of policies,
die.
That's necessarily true, and I just want to know what the words are that say death is bodily injury here.
I don't know what the particular policy here in the records, how they define death. We could look that up if it's important to you and submit mm-hmm. supplemental briefs. But I submit that in Lagerstrom, for instance, you said, I'm quoting from paragraph 30, the statute, that is 893.55 sub 7, does not limit the nature of the collateral source payments, and thus on its face seems to encompass payments such as those from the federal and state governments, life insurance, etc.
Then it goes on in paragraph 76, however, to talk about the evidence is relevant for purposes of reasonable value of medical services.
You say in Lagerstrom at paragraphs 27, 28, 30, 31, and 36 unequivocally that all collateral source, that the statute means what it says,
mm-hmm.
and that is any evidence of collateral source, regardless of the type, is admissible. And the legislative history that's attached, a copy of it as part of our appendix, makes that explicitly clear. This is an important part of the overall balance struck in 893.55. This is not a freestanding statute. When you look at 893.55, what you'll see is there's findings of fact by our legislature, why it's appropriate to strike this delicate balance there in Med-Mal cases about the caps on damages, the types of evidence admitted in Med-Mal cases, the statute of limitations, and the like. This isn't some kind of an a rule of evidence in the chapters 901 to 911. It's a damage statute. And I submit that to invite a test of relevance, which isn't suggested anywhere in Lagerstrom or Leitinger or your other cases, is a grave mistake, because, one, they don't propose what the test for relevance would be. What would the test be here for whether Mrs. Wiborg, the evidence of her getting, you know, the disability benefits or the life insurance, what would the relevance test be?
You just said it, counsel. You said twice this is a damage statute. So the relevance is to damages. And that's exactly what Lagerstrom said. This evidence is relevant as to the damages. In Lagerstrom, it was relevant to what was a reasonable fair market value of the health care provided. Now, once you take damages out of this case, is it your view that the collateral source rule, that is, I shouldn't say that. Once you take damages out, suppose at the very beginning of this case, we've stipulated as to damages, they are out. Is it your position then that in cross-examination or in direct examination, you can put in evidence of any collateral sources?
No. Had this case started...
Your position then, if there's no damages, there's no evidence of collateral source.
The first three or four days of this trial involved a lot of introduction of damage evidence about, you know, from the family, about the collateral source on three pages. None of that would have been relevant or admissible if there was a stipulation at the outset about damages. And then the question is...
I think that's very important.
Once it's in, then the question is, what do the parties choose to do about it? Do they seek an instruction or guidance or tell the jury how to interpret the evidence they've heard? And there was no request made by the plaintiff to assist the jury in that regard. Instead, the jury never heard another word for the next 5 days about damages from the defense, in closing, in instructions, or any other way.
Let me ask you another question. Damages were out by stipulation at the very beginning, and you introduced evidence of $1.3 million in collateral source. I don't care how you introduced it, you got it in. That would be error, right, to allow it.
I think so.
Right? That's it, because it doesn't go to damages. And then the jury brings in the verdict of no liability, as it did here. Your position is that's harmless error, right? You don't think the effect that the jury has heard, recovery of $1.3 million, would affect their decision on liability. Is that your position?
I think that the law is clear that juries should be presumed to follow the instructions that they were given. They were given here instructions solely on the liability questions. They were not told to consider any other evidence not bearing on liability. And I think it's appropriate for us to, you know, follow the normal presumption that juries follow those instructions in that situation. I would also, there were a number of questions about prejudice.
Okay. You were interrupted in your discussion of why there are three reasons that the confidence in the jury verdict is not undermined. One, that the rule in limine was correct. It's correct in the sense if that damages were at issue, if I understand it. Okay. What were two and three?
Okay. One is that it's correct as a matter of law. All collateral source evidence is admissible. The legislature is so specified in these types of cases. Two, whether you call it forfeiture or waiver, depending on your view of the decision that was issued last Friday, on how to characterize that. But here, by virtue of the stipulation, this issue was taken out of the case, and plaintiffs made no attempt to deal with that change in the circumstance of the case. And as Justice Crooks wrote in his decision last Friday, quote, this is at paragraph 24, the importance to the system of real appellate review and not merely endless error-correcting review requires holding parties accountable for the litigation strategies they choose in the circuit court. And so that's our second point. The third point was that any alleged error was harmless and are not reversible. And Mr. End, with all due respect, I think mischaracterizes what the trial judge said. He quotes very selectively from the trial judge's remarks at the end of the case in the motions after verdict. If you look at Mr. N's appendix at App 124 to 125, it's very clear what the trial judge said. I think Chief Justice put her finger on it. And I'm quoting at the top of 125, he says, "The issue is the prejudice and whether it is unduly prejudicial." And he says, "I stand by my ruling, etc." And he goes on at the bottom of 125, "The issue is whether it was too prejudicial back when it was presented during the trial." He goes on and says in this colloquy with counsel in the motions after verdict that any evidence that's introduced against a party is adverse, it's prejudicial in that sense, but that doesn't make it reversible error. The question is whether it undermines the court's confidence in the outcome of the case. That's the applicable standard. And the trial judge didn't suggest anything to the contrary.
No, one of the interesting things is, I don't know if you were here, Mr. Van Sicklin, for the first case, which was a criminal case.
No, I was outside, Your Honor.
Well, I don't know. The proceedings are, they can be heard outside, so I don't know if you heard them. But the issue was prejudicial or harmless error. And there's a case pending in the United States Supreme Court in a criminal case that may, you've been using the Chapman source of harmless error. But the court has used different standards for harmless error, and the case before the Supreme Court might interpret how you fit together all these harmless error tests, which this court has never done, and we shall see. So if there's error and we have to use the harmless error test, you think we should wait for the Supreme Court? States versus Vasquez.
Yeah, no, I vaguely am familiar with it. And my sense is certainly in federal law, there's a somewhat different standard used in judging reversible error issues in criminal cases than civil cases. Chief Justice Traynor, now deceased of the California Supreme Court, wrote a famous book about errors are the insects of the world. Some are benign, some are evil. But he made the distinction that it's appropriate and necessary to have somewhat different standards, civil and criminal. And I think our Chapman test here gets to the heart of it. And this, under my view of the case, was two or three questions over the space of three pages in a 1,900-page transcript about this collateral source evidence. And it was correct, and it wasn't, in the overall scheme of this 8-day jury trial, grounds to order a new trial. I'd like to briefly use the rest of my time, unless Justice Prosser has a question, to go to the jury instruction issue.
You talked about an 8-day jury trial. Do you remember how that broke down between plaintiff and defense?
I believe it was 3 days for the plaintiffs in their opening and 5 days once the defense case started. I could be wrong, but that's my recollection.
I think you alluded to a very strong defense. Of course, that's your interpretation. Do you think there's plenty of evidence in the record to say that none of these doctors was negligent?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the evidence, when you review those transcripts, was overwhelmingly in favor of the outcome here. I think if it was a closer case, you might have had a situation where one or two of the doctors was found negligent in some percentage, but you had three zeros. And I submit that was because of the very strong expert testimony about the standard of care, and the other evidence that these doctors practiced in an appropriate way here, and they weren't negligent. We weren't sitting there, obviously, listening to the credibility of the witnesses and all, but that's why I think it's appropriate to give a lot of weight to a jury verdict in a situation like that, this, and not lightly overturn it. There was an enormous investment of effort to present the facts and the testimony and the evidence to this jury, and I submit that these alleged errors, if they are errors, did not divert the jury from their truth-finding mission here, and it was accomplished. On the jury instruction...
Before you get to that, how would you write this opinion? Because Lagerstrom is a very strong opinion with strong dissents relating to the use of collateral source evidence. With Lagerstrom saying you can use it in damages, and you agree that it's a damage statute. But you can use it to show reasonable value of health care, but not, doesn't say you could use it for anything else. So how would you write this opinion in your favor?
What I would say, Your Honors, is I wondered why the court took this case at the outset and why it wasn't a case, I don't mean to be presumptuous in that, but that wasn't structured in a way because of the waiver issue and the stipulation that would not allow you to reach the merits of the collateral source issue. And what I think this case presents is a good opportunity for the court to reaffirm the basic notion that in a Med-Mal case, the legislature has made clear in that statute and its legislative history that any collateral source evidence is admissible, at least where damages are an issue in the case, in that it's not appropriate to suggest to trial courts they should embark in some kind of a relevance differentiation between the collateral source evidence. The legislature's made that determination, and what's happening in the trial courts is inconsistent outcomes, because some trial courts follow Mr. N's suggestion that we're going to look at each piece of collateral source evidence in a Med-Mal case and try to impose very inconsistent tests for relevance, and other courts say, like here, the statute's clear, the legislative intent's clear, Lagerstrom's clear, it's admissible. And you deal with it through an instruction at the end of the case.
Counsel, you say the statute's clear, but when I hear you tell me what the statute says, you say where damages are an issue. The statute doesn't say where damages are an issue. The statute's And the trial court judge also thought it was when damages are an issue. But it says it's information is admissible in an action to recover damages for Med-Mal. When I first read that, and as I read it now, you know, an action is liability and damages. So this is talking about the action. It's not where damages are in issue. That makes sense to me, but that's not the words of the statute. You're reading that into it.
I think it might be useful to step back and look at the broader context of 893.55, because on its face it says, it deals with itemization of damages. And it's part of a very comprehensive balance the legislature struck. And it came back and it articulated in the first two pages the legislative findings that supported the balance they struck about the amount of the Med-Mal cap on non-economic damages. They adjusted the statutes of limitation, and here at the end dealt with this important issue dealing with collateral source evidence. And as evidenced in the legislative history we put into our supplemental appendix, the legislature, I submit the only fair reading of that legislative history was that where damages are an issue, that it's appropriate to put that evidence in so the jury has the broader context of all the evidence that bear upon the situation of the family.
But that's not what the words of sub 7 say, is my point. You know,
I think maybe you could read the sub 7 as being vague in that sense, but I think it's a common sense construct that if the only issue is liability, they shouldn't be putting in evidence from the children about Mr. Wiborg. We shouldn't be putting in collateral source evidence. It's not an issue.
You see, I look at this statute, and there are a number of statutes where the legislature says certain kinds of evidence is admissible. And this says here, it is admissible. It doesn't say just for damages. It just says in an action for this kind of a med-mal. But that doesn't preclude courts from then doing a 90403, the prejudice analysis, or a court can still exercise discretion and keep it out. Here's an example, and there are many. Evidence of an appeal is admissible. I would look at that statute as a circuit court judge, and I'd say, okay, it can be admitted, but then I do a balancing test if there's an objection, and I keep it out. It doesn't mean I have to admit it. It means it is admissible.
Well, I think there's two things, Your Honor, is that I am not troubled by a construction of the statute that says that the is admissible relates to where damages are an issue in the case. And this evidence was admitted at the point in time where damages were still an issue in the case. Now, they could have asked for some instruction striking it once the stipulation happened and so forth. Now, I think that's a different question than embarking on the quest that Mr. End is suggesting, that as to each piece of collateral source evidence in a Med-Mal case where damages are at issue, that you engage in this relevance determination. Because I submit respectfully the legislature has already done that.
Wow.
It says any evidence of collateral source is admissible. I don't know
in
how you
an action to recover damages and not in an action for the recovery, you know, I mean, in an action for recovery damages, not where damages are an issue, as you said.
Well, this was a lawsuit to recover damages up until the stipulation. It remained arguably a lawsuit to get damages in a stipulated amount.
Absolutely. Why would they go to court if it wasn't an action for recovery of damages? That's different than what is an issue. Is damages an issue or is liability an issue? That's my problem.
Oh, I understand. It got complicated here because of the stipulation at the close of plaintiff's case. But again, I think getting back to the Chief's question, if there's a service that can come out of this case, I think to the bar is to provide guidance on whether or not this statute means that all collateral source evidence is admissible in a Med-Mal case where damages are involved, or do you engage in some, you know, piece of evidence by piece of evidence analysis of relevance? And I submit that's not what the legislature intended, and if the plaintiff's bar thinks that should be the outcome, they should ask the legislature to change the statute.
Well, it seems to me that you'd have to reverse Lagerstrom. Because Lagerstrom said you can admit collateral source if it goes to a piece in the case and if it's relevant. And the court said, okay, you can admit the collateral source, which related to the value of the services, because it's relevant to a factor in the case, which is what is the fair market value of the healthcare services. So it limited that. Now the dissent, well, there was several concurrences and dissents. You can read, but don't have to read, some of the concurrence and dissent to say all collateral evidence is admissible once you have damages as the issue.
Yes, what
do you do with Lagerstrom?
I think Lagerstrom, on the paragraphs I quoted, is directly in support of our position
here.
But
the holding of the case is not.
I don't think the holding is directly on point, and I think Justice, you know, Prosser there in his dissent is arguing that more effect should be given to collateral source evidence. It should be an offset and so forth.
What is its value in the case?
We're questioning the legislative wisdom there, Your Honor. I think it has they've decided that when you look at those legislative findings in 893.55, they go through them. And I know this is a debate we had in Ferdin and Morin and all these other cases.
Oh, that's why I was so glad to see you. I figured we're going to have the debate again.
But But that's where it is. And if I could just use a moment, I just
May, counsel.
Two minutes touch on the jury instruction issue. Our position there is that there was more than one adjustment to the two pattern instructions. There was the phrase that Mr. N's clients complain about, but what also got added by the trial judge was the next optional sentence in the pattern instruction 260 that tells you how to use the conflicting evidence submitted by the experts on the question of the standard of care. We submit that taken together, the two instructions with both of the modifications, they're in our appendix, if you read them together, they give a fair and accurate statement of Wisconsin law, which is that on the standard of care issue, you must use the expert testimony to guide you. You can't rely on your own sense of what's right or standards or any other evidence. It has to depend on the experts. And then the very next sentence that the judge added after this question phrase was made clear how you handle conflicting expert testimony. And Wisconsin law is crystal clear that you don't cherry-pick out a phrase in a jury instruction and decide whether that's error. You look at it in the full context of the both instructions as given. And we submit that, as the trial judge said, those are accurate and right. But even if not, we submit, again, on the harmless error issue, that the Court of Appeals had it right, that when you look at the overall, you know, evidence in this case and the outcome, you should have confidence that the right result was reached. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen. Mr. End, Attorney End.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first point that I think is really important, I want to make it again, is the point I opened with, that if we are going to allow into our jury trials evidence that is not relevant and evidence that is prejudicial, then something is wrong in the courts of Wisconsin. And under no circumstances, and I am surprised that the defense has taken this position, how can you take the position that the legislature intended for irrelevant and prejudicial testimony to come into trials? It doesn't make sense. And Mr. Van Sicklen says, well, we don't want to burden the judge with making this relevancy decision on a case-by-case basis. I say we sure do. That's what we've been doing since we began our judicial history, is judges run the show. Judges determine what evidence ought to be submitted. Judges determine what evidence is relevant to the issues the jury will decide. And that is the point I'm making, and I think we have to make sure that that's what comes out of this decision. The legislature cannot carte blanche say, we're taking over. Our system of judicial being and judicial doing is out the window because we're going to let everything in because this is a medical malpractice case. And in response to the medical malpractice situation, as you may have seen in my brief, and I personally think this is scary, but of the 50 states, a person in Wisconsin has the least chance of anybody in the country of recovering compensation because of medical negligence. The National Practitioner Data Bank for 2010, in our state of 5.6 million people, there were 44 people who recovered compensation because of doctor negligence. The fund has $912 million, has a surplus of $272 million. If I ever get to this court again to argue, my bet is the fund will have over $1 billion in it. So to justify what the defense is asking be justified here does not make any sense. I think the goal of this court system should be, we are going to make sure that our trials are fair. We're going to make sure that our trials are just. We're not going to let prejudicial evidence into our trials so that the result that we see here today happens again. And there was a question made about the strength of the case. And I was there. I know the strength of the case. And what happened was, let me find it. There were two parts of this test, the stress test, which was properly ordered. There was an abnormality on the nuclear medicine thing where the doctor said, I think you have an infarct. I see an infarct. That's a heart attack, an old heart attack. On the EKG, the findings, as I have at page 4 of my brief, there's an early second stage onset of ST depression, a poor prognostic indicator. There was a continuation of the ST depression into the first 8 minutes, a poor prognostic indicator. There's an ST depression in multiple leads, a poor prognostic indicator. The evidence in this case, I tell you, and again, I'm prejudiced, but I was there, was very strong that Mr. Wiborg, at age 42, going to the doctor because of chest pain that was classic for angina, ends up dying at age 42 because the appropriate steps were not taken. This was a very strong case of liability. And to give you an idea as to what the state of the law is these days, our other partner, Sean Crane, next week will begin his third trial in the last 5 years where a spine surgeon operated at the wrong level of the cervical spine. The insurance company is offering zero, as it did on the other two. The state of affairs in Wisconsin is the chances of a victim actually recovering compensation are so small, the insurance companies don't care. They're taking them to trial.
Maybe you should approach the legislature about no-fault malpractice. You know, they have that in some states where you don't have to prove fault. If you get a bad result, you get an award, but that has to be a legislative determination.
And the fact is, I stay really on top of this, and there are medical studies that would show it in Wisconsin every year. There are 32,000 people who die or are injured by medical malpractice. There's a study, April of 2011, in Health Affairs. 1.5 million people in the country in hospitals, and we have 44 out of our 32,000. But to answer your question, if we got into a no-fault situation, it would break the bank. Because we can't compensate 32,000, we have 44 people now we're compensating.
You probably would have a regulation on the amount of compensation that's paid for each type of injury, like we do for workers' compensation. I mean, it wouldn't just be no fault if you have a bad injury and you get any kind of damages. So I would imagine it'd be a comprehensive system. But some states have done that, probably for the reasons that you put forth.
Yeah. So anyway, I see I have my red light on, but and I guess I've said what I need to say. Thank you very much. Yes,
Justice Prosser has a question.
The stipulation, that's $1 million. Was there more than $1 million too?
No.
It was just $1 million.
It was an entire stipulation for that amount.
All right. If you had prevailed at trial, would the jury have had to break down that $1 million some way?
No. The stipulation was if we win, we get $1 million, and we're not going to break, even though the statute, as you know, says you're supposed to break it down, but that would not have happened in this case. And it was all either loss of society and companionship and pecuniary loss. Those were the only two elements that were involved in this case.
And have had to divide it out for income tax purposes.
Even if you recover compensation for pecuniary loss, it's not taxable if it's a tort case.
And you don't.
Yeah.
But sometimes you do in these tort cases.
Your expert testified on the damages?
Yes.
And it was a little over $1 million. How did he break it down?
I have that information. I just looked at it again. Yeah, Professor Breeden determined that the loss of income to the family. So it's his income minus his personal consumption was $953,000. And then his household services valued at $12 an hour came to $136,000 for a total of $1,089,585. So those were the pecuniary damages that were proved at the trial. And then, of course, there was that potential $350,000 maximum recovery for loss of society.
That's capped by statute.
That's capped by statute.
Any other questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. End, and
thank you,
Mr. Van Sicklen. This is medical malpractice cases have come to the court with some frequency in the last several years. They always present yet a different aspect of the statutes involved and are, present very important legal issues. That concludes our hearing in 10-AP-258, Teresa C. Weber versus Donald V. Jenny et al. The students may stay, and Justice Bradley will be out to talk with them. The court's in recess till 1:30, when it will hear our third case today and the last scheduled case for March arguments. Sounds like a